I want you, first of all, to observe how proud Ismael Garcia is of your shoes.
The boots. From the hike house.
These are boots from the Holden Hike House. He says they're the most comfortable shoes he's ever had. And he's not going to take them off again.
No, he's sleeping with them.
Sleeping with them, eating with them, lecturing in them.
Those shoes will never more be Holden.
Wunderbar. Never more be Holden. Good. Well, yeah.
Jill?
Yes?
Before you get into your favorite subject, way up here, something that's very close to my heart. What hope is there in my lifetime for reconciliation between Lutherans and Roman Catholics? Given especially the tenor of the change in deteriorating and all that business in the century of teachers and priests.
I think some Lutherans and some Roman Catholics could get together without any difficulty. Most of us are feeling a bit pessimistic about anything coming anytime very soon, although someone said, we were talking about these matters, that a different pope could change it very quickly, and that the tide seems to be running in the other direction. I'm not sure how true that is. I hope it's true. But what we're trying to do is clear away some of the underbrush so that it'll be easier to accomplish, given the doctrinal kinds of difficulties we were just talking about. You'd be surprised, though, how some of those things... With all those things endure. We've done a good deal, and the dialogue has accomplished a good deal, but the one we're on now is really sticky. I think we're having a harder time with this because it's dealing with merit, purgatory, and all those nitty-gritty sorts of things from the Reformation that really are, do separate us probably more than some of the other kinds of things. But if you've read the dialogue books, then you know that our conclusion has been every time that there's nothing that ought to be church dividing between us. And even on Eucharist and ministry, you know, that's what affects intercommunion, ministry, and what we believe in the Eucharist. What we believe about the Eucharist is not the problem. Ministry was more of a problem, because the Catholics would be slow to acknowledge that Lutheran ordination gives the power to consecrate. And because you're not, you don't intend to sacrifice, obviously. But that was all worked out, so that the conclusion was that we shouldn't be divided on this. And so one would hope that something like the relationship that Lutherans now have with Episcopalians could be worked out. And certainly there are degrees of ecumenical exchange all over the United States amongst bishops and priests and pastors and people. I hope that'll increase. I hope there'll be more interface with Catholics and Lutherans at the parish level. But we really don't see that. We don't see it, but we're certainly having a lot of difficulty getting Rome to see it. Rome came back with an answer that really distressed me in one thing, reviewing the dialogues. And there's some of them that want to hang on to transubstantiation. Well, to me, that served its purpose in a time past, but no Roman Catholic even knows what a substance is anymore. I mean, they don't. A substance is this stuff. This is a rock. That's a substance. I mean, they don't understand substance and accident. And it just isn't a really viable way of explaining that. So, but there are some that say, and I said, well, you've just thrown it out because you're not going to get Lutherans to agree to transubstantiation. It's a fight word.
What's the difference between consubstantiation and transubstantiation in essence?
Well, Luther attached to transubstantiation the whole business of sacrifice, works, righteousness, and everything else that there you could dump into it. It's a fight word, a banner word. And there's no point in fighting over it, because what we really believe is the same. That's what you were asking. What,
yeah, because I can never figure out what the difference in a philosophical point of view. There isn't any.
How it happens, we have no business inquiring. I mean, for goodness sakes, there's nothing in the... But Jesus didn't say, I transubstantiate this bread into my body. And if he didn't say how he was doing it, that the princes, that's another thing they said. 1568, the princes said, there will be no further discussion of the how of the Lord's Supper. And guess who broke it first? Flacius Illyricus. Any of you who know the history of it, you know Flacius? The Nazio Lutheran with a vengeance. And he couldn't keep his mouth shut. But really none of them wanted to. It's just ferocious. So I don't know in your lifetime. I would hope so. But right now, and John Paul II looks like he's going on for some time. And not in his lifetime, let's put it that way. I think when women are ordained, that's going to be another big problem, you see, for real kinds of reunion, because Lutherans, many ordain women, and that's anathema. And I think one of the things that will stop Catholics, really, is their hope for reunion with the Eastern churches, and the Eastern churches are going to be slower than Rome.
But isn't that the Lutherans and the Protestants are also fighting? I don't know if you know about the Leuenberg Concord, which was about to be signed by all the Lutheran parties, but they couldn't even agree about the Eucharist.
Well, there's that.
Leuenberg?
No, Lutheran disagreement about the Eucharist and lack of intercommunion amongst Lutherans in some areas. So there's that, but now that you're all getting together in one church, should go better.
What should go better?
Lutheran agreement. One would hope.
Well, don't you know, maybe you don't know, but the major unsolved issue is ministry yet. It's purposely left ambiguous and vague, and I wouldn't put any money on any timetable for solution. I don't know who would. Walter, would you put a timetable on
6 years?
We're going to have some seminaries who will be fighting the bad loud, and then the church will have to decide which one to go with, I guess, or something like that. I mean, the theological faculties are really lining up on both sides of the debate about ministry, which
but,
have to
but
be
you
good.
See, but we don't have a doctrine of ministry in the American Lutheran Church, so why would we fight for one or agree to one if one ever came up?
Well, okay, I. Some think we do have a doctrine of ministry.
But we don't.
But
may I ask a question about, would you be willing to comment on what has happened relative to Archbishop Hunthouse?
To Archbishop Hunthouse?
Where he has been stripped of five of his basic...
We're all bewildered. You know, we were talking about that. You know, who the Catholic members of the dialogue are people there. Well, five of them are from Catholic University. Avery Dulles and Joe Fitzmyer, Beth Johnson, and Carl Peter, who was dean of the undergraduate college. I'm not so sure what he was dean of, but he was dean for a while. And Bob Eno, Robert Eno. And so I thought, oh goody, I'll find out what's going on at Catholic U about Curran. And we talked about Curran and we talked about Hunthausen. We're just bewildered. I don't know any more than you know from your press. You probably know more because your press has covered it much better than the national press. But it's rather unheard of that anything like this should be done. I have a feeling that they're after him for many things. I think they're making an example of him to the other American bishops. I don't know.
Do you think it's primarily the peace issue?
I think it's that, and he's not paying taxes. I think it's he's an outspoken man. And well, I spoke to one bishop a bishop who's fairly conservative. I didn't mean to. I was. Sometimes I'm not politic at all.
Not a politic.
And we were just chatting, and I was speaking about some bishops in the West that I admired. One of them was Bishop Busby in Pueblo, Colorado, who's gotten older now. He was wonderful, and he broke down all the old formalities and things between bishops and people. He didn't kiss his ring and all of it. I mean, he was a wonderful and liberal bishop, and I thought the world of him. That didn't seem to sit very well with this bishop. And then I said, "Then there's Hunthausen, and I think he's terrific too." And he said, "Why do you think he's so good?" And I said, "Well, I think he lives out what he believes." And the bishop didn't like that very well either. And he said, "Well, what are you trying to say?" And I said, "Well, I think that many bishops in the church, along with as to human institution as well as a divine one, if you want to take it that way, has to make compromises." Well, he didn't like that either. I said, "Hunthausen doesn't compromise. And then he said, "Could we change the subject?" I mean, he didn't want to talk about it. I think he felt he's very much on Rome's side of everything. And if Rome was doing something here, it was probably okay, and Hunthausen probably deserved it. But Hickey is behind, Hickey's behind both of these, Curran and Hunthausen. Some of us think that if they keep pushing like this, at least, well, there was a time when the Dutch church looked like it was on the edge of schism. And I think Avery Dulles said that Rome is treating us as though we were the Dutch church. They're afraid that we're getting too far out on a limb. What I think may be happening is they may be turning us into the Dutch church. But I don't like this at all. I think this is just wrong. And
one of my friends in the Roman church told me that just a week ago, or less than a week ago, that there were about 15,000 signatures just from the diocese already asking that this could change.
Well, I hope they go someplace, but I'm not sure, since the church is not a democracy, I'm not sure it's just going to make a big difference. And but the man has suffered so, and he thought he was doing a good job, but apparently the people in Seattle think he's doing a good job. And this fellow, the picture that I saw in this Intelligencer, yeah, with Bishop Worrell sitting there, I tell you, he looks so smug. I want to kill him.
Come on,
I thought he was so terrible.
I would
throw a tomato in his face or something. He just was sitting there. I have their control of the situation. I'm Rome's chosen. I will smooth it all out. I will handle it all. I don't know the man, but the picture was terrible. I felt so bad for Bishop Hunthausen.
Why should Lutherans want to unite with
I don't know.
With that Rome?
Oh, I really don't think you would. Not unless the lines of agreement were spelled out in such ways that these sorts of things were absolutely impossible. No, I wouldn't. I mean, I feel very loosely associated these days myself.
Was there precedent to
copy your copy when I... Copy.
Yes.
Very good. One of the Seattle columnists had this theory that Hunthausen's outspoken negative on the nuclear submarines and his refusal to pay taxes was irritating Washington, D.C. and the Reagan administration, and that the administration had gotten to the apostolic delegate and said, "Can you put a little pressure on this fellow? He's causing us a lot of trouble out in the Northwest," and so that there's a mixture of politics in this thing. Could you speculate on that one?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting situation that we've got in the United States right now with the Bishops' Conference and the administration in Washington. I wouldn't put anything past anybody. actually, at this point. But the last two letters of the bishops on economics in the United States and the nuclear situation, and what Cardinal Bernardine had to say when he came back from Nicaragua, and the whole situation about Central America. This is really the first time that the bishops have taken a line contrary to Washington. That's something kind of new under the sun, and I don't think Rome likes it. And I'm not exactly sure why, because John Paul II is not exactly a nuclear... he's not for all that kind of thing. But he doesn't want the church involved in these kinds of political situations. But that has always seemed to me rather strange, since he never goes anywhere without getting very political himself. And that there may have been some of that, I couldn't speculate on it, because I have no information. And I'm a historian enough not to say that's probably likely or something when I have no evidence that it is. On the other hand, nothing much would surprise me. I wonder what... I think there's certainly a message being given to the American hierarchy by Rome in Humphausen's person. That I'm sure of. That something went through Washington as a possibility would not surprise me, but I don't think even it would have been a determinative voice.
Okay, Jerry,
was there a precedent for sending an auxiliary commission?
I don't think so. Not with these powers. Not even to impose one that wasn't one that he'd recommended. Usually a bishop, I mean, you want them to work together, so you have some say on who comes in. To take over the duties that a bishop has, I mean, to teach and to administer the sacraments, those are the things he's supposed to supervise above all else. And to take over seminarians, sacramental life, it's unheard of.
I didn't even know it was within the realm of possibility to do that except for removal. But this is really, appointing another bishop who is really not a bishop in his place.
Back
I don't know if we want to stay on this topic a while yet, but it's all right. It's religion and politics.
I have one question about this topic. Okay. I would agree that Archbishop Hunthausen is what you said he is, a man of really deep and conviction, who lives by his own convictions. But he's also convinced that what the convictions he lives by are what his church has said in Vatican II. Mm-hmm. That he is a loyal servant of that council. Mm-hmm. And I think he would see that what's happening to him now is an attempt almost to reverse Vatican II. Don't quote him as saying that. That's my interpretation. But I did hear him say this. I know that I've lost credibility with Rome. I had credibility however many years ago when they made me a bishop, and I had credibility again when they made me an archbishop, and I haven't changed. And I'm wondering if you see that in Rome now there's a moving away from Vatican II.
Well, I think I could say that I mentioned conciliarism tonight. And I wasn't kidding. I said conciliarism was pretty much put down at Basel in the 15th century. It had a brief flare of success. And the popes just put their thumbs right on it and it didn't come alive again. But in Vatican II, the Council of Bishops in each country was given powers that they had not had before and were allowed to meet and make decisions and not always have to run to Rome for everything. It was a really decentralizing move. And I do think Rome's taking back some of that. I do.
Yeah. Good.
I think that what you said a while ago is the way I look at it. that what Rome is doing to Hunthausen is to make him an example. And that's why we do not see any strong support from the Council of Bishops in support of Hunthausen. I've seen a few, but not much. And it's, and I don't think it's ever going to come because they're afraid of what has happened, might happen to them, has happened to him.
You know, there's something going, I don't know. I mean, I'm speculating now, not as anybody on the ins, because I'm not with the bishops. I used to know Archbishop Bernadine before he was a council through ecumenical. It was quite interesting. It was at George Anderson's seminary in South Carolina for Reformation Day with Paul Impey and Archbishop Bernadine and myself. And we had quite a good conversation about the possibility of the ordination of women, and I got a distinct feeling that that personally he wasn't against it. He said something about his public persona and his private persona. And someone else has told me that the majority of bishops, if not the majority, a large number, would not be against it if there were any kind of possibility of bringing it along. But they are, this corporate group that they are is interesting. I think if they ever did get together as and speak their own minds, Rome might be surprised.
Yeah. Well, that survey that was taken of bishops illegally certainly brought that up between the official
position.
That's opposition.
Anonymous.
Mm-hmm. What?
That's anonymous.
Yes.
Well, it's a difficult situation, and yet they are in a position, I mean, I would hate to be in it, where they must speak for the church. That's their job. And how the private and the public persona, well, you all face it too, in when you must speak for the church as a pastor, a Lutheran pastor, and sometimes you may wonder personally if that that you're expressing, which the church has declared, is really what you want to do, perhaps. I should think it would happen on occasion. It used to happen to me teaching in a Catholic school. That's one of the reasons I don't teach in Catholic schools. It really got to be a little bit oppressive. The distance between what I had to teach and what I was thinking about got too far apart, so I just stopped doing it.
Okay, Bob?
This is a little bit different, but you were mentioning a while back the ordination of women. And I imagine the crucial part of that would come down to being able to celebrate the Mass. Could you make some comments about women in the pulpit in the Catholic Church? Part of the background for that is that we have an Episcopal priest in a covenant parish situation we have, and she'll probably be preaching mm-hmm. in January at one of the Catholic Churches.
Well, you just heard a sermon tonight I thought was splendid.
I
have no problem with that at all, but the Roman Church, I mean, one of the things Hunthausen is being called down for is altar girls. And Bernardine, who I think really probably didn't mind altar girls at all, but he had to tell the parishes in Chicago not to have altar girls, and some little altar girl wrote him a letter. It was very touching and all. And I really think that was a place where the private Bernardine was really didn't want to have to do that. They don't even like women to be readers anymore. And goodness, I don't know, in all the parishes I know, women read, women distribute communion. They're doing, and I thought that was a giveaway a long time ago. As soon as you have women distributing communion, why don't you go ahead and ordain them, for goodness sake? But I certainly have no objection at all to women in the pulpit.
I guess I was asking if in the American Catholic Church, how
that's
viewed.
That's a problem. You know what they've done? Priests, when they want a woman to say something from the pulpit, what they do is they read the gospel and they start the sermon. So the priest is giving the sermon, right? Then they invite the woman to say something. And then she goes on and preaches. But it always has to be that kind of a thing. And it's not done that often, I don't think. But the more it's done, the better. Oh, the other thing I said to this poor bishop, oh dear, was that I thought Bishop Busby would probably be the one that if any bishop is asked to ordain women a la the Episcopal Church, that he would be the one to do it. And he says, oh, I hope not. That would be a mistake, he said. Well, I didn't think it would be such a terrible mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, you already mentioned Father Curran as an academician. Could you give your views about that case?
That's another toughie in some ways, but I think Father Curran should be allowed to continue to teach. I can understand the argument of people who say if you are teaching as an official member of the church in a pontifical university, which Catholic University is, Notre Dame is not, Fordham is not, Georgetown is not, but Catholic University is, then maybe you have to, maybe there is something to the thing that says if you're going to play in the ballpark, play by the rules. On the other hand, Curran argues that he is within the bounds, and that he has never gone outside the bounds in raising the issues and discussing the problems he does in the way he discusses them. But again, Father Curran is like Hunthausen. He's one of the most respected moral theologians amongst other moral theologians and people in the church who are not ultra-conservative. And this is an intrusion from Rome into Catholic University business, which has, as its, Catholic University has as its chancellor, Archbishop Hickey, again, same man. But it's going to be a tenure fight. So that's where it's going to come down. And it's going to be long and hard and disruptive. And it's just a pity.
Doesn't this scare many of the younger scholars? I mean, soon you're so afraid that you can't say almost anything.
I don't think so, because they're not going to be in a pontifical university. See, and they're not going to be teaching ethics or morals. So it's not that. Another thing that bothers me, though, of the same thing was the disciplinary action against the nuns who signed that thing. It's Rome just seems to be coming in and saying you can't do this and you can't do that and you can't do the other to a degree. It's almost a new campaign against what's conceived of in Rome as a new modernism or a new Americanism or all that kind of stuff at the end of the 19th century that made Rome come down on Americans so hard, and new oaths of allegiance and all that kind of thing. But I'm something of a maverick, so you can't take what I think as as anything other than one person's opinion about it. But it does distress a great many. I think if you want to see where Catholics that are from the middle to liberal are thinking, the National Catholic Reporter provides that kind of commentary and position. And if you want to know what the conservatives think, read The Wanderer and and listen to William Buckley.
Hans Kung says that Rome and the Curia are going to be left in the dust for the new paradigm that's coming into the Catholic Church.
If he's a prophet, that's fine. But I think Hans Kung hopes that will be. Yeah. But he will have been one in a long line who have spoken that way. And it goes on. I mean, there it is. It goes on. So I don't know what's going to happen with the Roman Catholic Church. But this is a time that's getting quite serious for Catholics. You had a question?
Yeah, no.
I wanted to make one comment and then ask a question. But the comment is to do with the openness of many bishops to the Roman Catholic Church to have married priests. When Bishop Crumley came to Alaska and went through with Bishop Blevins, we had a breakfast with Bishop Michael Kenney of Juneau. You may have heard him. He's supported Hunthausen and very anti-nuclear and very pro-peace and many other things. And one of the things that he discussed, it was fun. My wife and I were there listening to the bishops talk, you know, and we were like little mice, very quiet, unusual for me, of course. The way that he described the difficulties they're having getting priests, and that the quality of the single males that they're getting is so low, and they're having so many mental problems in this, with these priests and seminary training. They're not getting a high quality at all. And they took a vote in their national conference, and it was about two-thirds in favor of having married priests in America, and sent a delegation to the Pope, which, of course, all this wasn't made public. And the answer, of course, was no. But they're convinced in their own circles that they must move that, and it's just a matter of time, or maybe a matter of hopes, whatever that means. So the other question is, to what degree have you observed this ecumenical dialogue with the Baptism Eucharist Ministry report?
What, the Lima report?
Yeah, the Lima report. To what degree has that seemed to have had an impact on the Roman Catholic Church from your perspective?
No. I don't think these things are going to have an impact except on individuals who say that's good and we'd like to do it, but it's got to have some official backup, and it's just not there. The official backup, I don't feel, is coming from Rome. When we sent them the justification volume, they wrote back and said, hooray, isn't that nice that you've done this? We're so glad we're going to read everything you've written with great interest. And I thought, everything I've ever written. I hope that they read the Vagina Dentata sometime. But anyway, I don't think they did, or I probably would have been off the dialogue. But then they came back with criticisms that were just, it was as though we hadn't done a thing. Really. And we're dealing with the Curia. And the Curia. The people who run the papal government. The Curia was founded by Gregory VII in order to get a little power against the nobles, to just have a little bit more strength within a generation or two. Bernard of Clairvaux was saying that the Curia is out of hand. Suppress it. And that's been the cry ever since, and Hans Kuhn and the rest. Clean it up or get rid of it, said Bernard. And all it does is, like any bureaucracy, has become more entrenched, a little larger, and more conservative. And that's who we deal with. The popes have strength, and they can say things, but the Curia runs many popes. And the Curia are not going to yield on any of these things. And they really are resistant. And there I agree with Hans Kuhn. The Curia is the area of intransigence more than almost any other. Oh, it took John 23rd to say, we're having a council. If left to the Curia, we'd have a council in 2050, maybe. And John just said, we're having one. I'm Pope, I can do it. We're having one. And he sort of did it over their dead bodies. And ever since, they've been trying to get to backtrack. That's where it's coming from.
John?
In some sense, you just answered my question, but back to the issue of Charles Curran. He was on one of these evening News Programs 2020 or she committed a few weeks ago, and they were interviewing Curran, and it seems to me that there are does refute aspects of Humana Vitae in relation to the issue of birth control and some other things. The question I have is, you mentioned that if he's going to play in that ballpark, then he has to play by the rules. Is there not some way to play in the ballpark and get the rules changed? And if that's not, if one can't do that within this country, are there no voices in Rome for the Curia itself whereby that can happen, or are we at a loss?
I doubt there's anybody in the Curia that can speak that way. I think they're chosen and trained so they don't speak that way. I may be wrong, but I would be very surprised to hear otherwise. That's for as far as Humanae Vitae goes, is never worked. I mean, that's one of the great jokes in the American Catholic Church. I mean, I know Catholics who are the pillars of their churches, and they go to communion every week, and maybe on Wednesdays. You know, I mean, they're always there. And they've had vasectomies or tubal ligatures and that kind of thing. There is no way. I mean, the matters of conscience that the priests have had to deal with in this matter, the priests themselves are not observing it in their advice to people because they know they can't. I remember once one priest saying, it's all very well to say, use so-called natural methods, which I've always thought most unnatural. But anyway, they'd say, I know a woman who, doesn't matter what, I mean, if you shake hands with her, she'll conceive. They've got 10 kids, and they really can't support more, and it's just the end of the line. They've got to do something. And he said, I can't tell them to abstain for the rest of their lives, which is what it would be. That's what it would be for that couple. They had tried the natural method. They were faithful Catholics. They tried, and they had 7 more kids. I mean, it just didn't work. So what is you tell? Abstain? I mean, that seems to be what the... Take up your cross, say these wonderful celibates in Rome. And so, what, 80% of Catholics practice birth control that's not approved by Rome? So the question of authority has already been bent by that Humanae Vitae situation. All Curran is doing is dealing with human reality in ways that he thinks are Christian and Catholic. And so I said, I can understand people who make that argument, but I don't. I think the ballpark should be considerably enlarged. But Drynan, that was another thing when the Pope said step down out of Congress, and he did, and I was sort of disappointed. I wished he had said, no, this is a responsibility given me by these citizens, but he said religion and politics will separate them, okay, and I'll be a good Jesuit and go back to my business and get out of Congress. But I don't see a resolution to this problem myself, but again, I have to stress that I'm not in a position to see very well. I'm not in a Catholic university. I'm not talking very well with any bishops. Not at this point. And people who ought to be in positions where they do know something are as bewildered as I am, like Avery Dulles or Carl Peter, who goes to Rome and he sits on some kind of delegation there every once in a while. But he says, as soon as he gets to Rome, he consoles himself by saying, I'm leaving soon, I'm leaving soon, I'm leaving soon. Keeps himself sane. So
isn't the intransigence that we see, though, can I follow up just for a second? Intransigence that we see there, and by that I'm not accusing, because Lutherans at various points and today continue in such intransigence in a variety of areas. Doesn't it relate to that trust thing that you have raised, I think, yesterday, that when someone is called into question, or the authority is called into question, or the assumption or tradition is called into question, the reaction is like the animal who's being beat upon. Mm-hmm. You know, you entrench a little bit, and you fight harder and stronger than you have before, and that's the position of non-trust. And it seems to me that I hear that in Curran, and I saw the pain in the eyes of Charles Curran as I watched, and I so empathized with that almost helplessness that he felt against a church that would not move.
I don't know Charles Curran. I think I met him once, but I don't know the man, and I don't know where he's getting his strength or how he will hold up. But if he does hold up and he does have strength, it will be because he's a man of prayer. Because I don't see in Charles Curran, in his answers or anything else, he's quiet, he says what he thinks, but he's not fighting, he's not lashing out, he's not being bitter about it. He just explains what he's doing, how he's doing it, and so on. And I think that's probably going to get him more votes than almost anything else, is the way he's conducting himself.
No, I have been wondering whether part of this is that Rome has decided that they have to deal with the United States more than they deal with other parts of the world. My information is probably 12 or 13 years old now, but in Africa, at least until recently, one of the big problems was that if they consecrated many more bishops, they wouldn't have any more African priests because of the difficulty of getting celibate clergy, and similarly in New Guinea. And speaking of the women, distributing the sacrament, it seems that in Africa a priest will be responsible for maybe 50, 60 congregations, and he will come to a place and consecrate, not a good word, a swatch of the host, and then the nuns on the spot will be responsible for the distribution of it from Sunday to Sunday until he can get around the next time. And in New Guinea, I was with the Marist, the provincial of the Marist Order, and he was showing me a syllabus for a catechist seminary in Alexishaupen in Papua New Guinea. And then you could see that the moment that there would be a permission to ordain these people, they could pretty well pull out a list and say, these people are very well trained, they have gotten it all. And yet you don't hear anything about, no one seems to be excited about that. They seem to be going right to the edge, almost as far as anything in America, except that they're not screaming for ordination of women or ordination of ordained clergy.
Very
good.
One of the places where they are coming down on that, though, is in South America. Mm-hmm. These comunidades de bases are the same kind. Giving powers to, catechists doing more than Rome would like non-ordained individuals to do. That's part of the suspicion, isn't it, in these communities. And they're getting some heat for that. I thought that probably married clergy would be coming along fairly soon simply because of the terrific pressure and the need for clergy. But Rome is going to be very, very slow on that one. And there they haven't got even the Eastern Church who's been doing it. But can you say anything about what's going on down there, Ismael?
In Church of the Latin American.
Yeah, in the Comunidades.
It's similar. Tremendous amount of difficulty getting local priests, because of the strong sense of family and upbringing of children. So most of the priests, and a great deal of them, come from Europe, Spain, Portugal, a lot of them. And many of the people that are trained in Spanish, so they know the language. They have to travel a tremendous amount of areas to attend a tremendous amount of parishes that they just can't keep. And gradually, the Catholic community has done. They've looked at the Pentecostal community, how that grows, and you know, they figure out, well, if they could have your nice celebrations, why can't we have ours? And if they can do your things, why can't we have ours? And they still remain loyal. the Catholic Church. I mean, Catholics have always had a strong sense of unity of the Church, very strong sense of unity of the Church. And therefore, they do wait for the priest, and they do a number of things, holding on for the priest. But the dynamic is the same. Just because of historical accident, they are learning the value of autonomy, and they can handle many of the things they can do. And the Church in Latin America is divided from top to bottom. So you have a lot of bishops supporting the base community. Mm-hmm. It's not only the base that wants it. And this division within the Church is creating a little bit of concern of whether or not there could be a schism, whether or not they will remain faithful. So many things are very similar.
Yeah, Ron?
Change the subject a bit.
Yes.
I think that in the Lutheran Church, what has evolved to be known as the Two Kingdom Theory or practice has had a strong influence on the perspective and or perhaps confusion of the relationship of church, religion, and politics. Going back to the 16th century, what was happening politically and or historically that might have influenced Luther in the way he wrote about the spiritual kingdom and the secular kingdom? Mm-hmm. And how did that writing impact the common people of that day?
The thing that makes the question a little difficult is that Luther's doctrine on that was not that clear always.
And I'm not sure he wrote it as a doctrine.
Well, his teaching. Rather than, I meant doctrine in that sense of his teaching, and it shifted some. But I think that he was astounded by the peasant uprising. And his reaction to that was, obey your lords. And the other side was, well, obey your lords, but everybody in his or her place obeys authority. And someone raised that, I don't know if they're here, raised that the other day, and put it very well. That the directions, everybody in the 16th century, the general theory in the 16th century was that you had to obey constituted authority. Children obeyed their parents, citizens obeyed their magistrates, magistrates obeyed their princes, princes obeyed their emperor, and so on, pretty much. And if someone in a position of authority was ungodly, then you had to go through the proper channels to unseat that person. So that there was a respect for state parental authority that was very strong. And one of the things that was really returned to medieval doctrine, but that was if a ruler were ungodly, then the people could themselves rise without getting the leadership of a prince of the blood or something of that kind, or sort of moving toward a more democratic attitude. But Luther was very much in favor of the dukes defending the church. The dukes and the lords tended very often to take more direction of their own churches in the 16th century, and theologians were often kind of house theologians. And they were hired because they went along with what the duke was wanted them to teach, or that some very influential theologian in the court wanted them to teach. So that there was both a separation and an alliance. And what I was talking about tonight was an establishment of religion. you know, the cuius regio, eius religio, whoever rules his religion is in that area, is the established religion of that area. That's what the people of Montbéliard were dealing with. The Duke of Württemberg was Lutheran, and he had the right to establish Lutheranism in that territory. So there was a marriage of church and state in that instance. The two kingdoms, I'm trying to remember because it switches at one point and it's not so clear cut. Anybody help me? Has anybody done work on Luther's doctrine of that? I'm having difficulty getting it straight
in my
mind.
Did you have something
right
behind
now.
Your question? I mean, some information you wanted enlightenment on, or some idea
well,
about what happened?
A curiosity of mine, and that
yeah.
is...
what influences two kingdom doctrine?
If with Frederick the Wise protecting Luther, uh-huh. as he did throughout, was his writing reflective of that protection by the state?
Oh, I see what you mean. No, I think it was more... that I think Luther was quite orthodox in reflecting attitudes in the 16th century on that, more than being influenced by Frederick's protecting him. I remember what the problem was. The two kingdoms seemed to be the kingdom of God and the kingdom almost of the devil. And then he had to loosen that theory and have the kingdom of God and the kingdom of the world that is fairly neutral. In other words, you can be a good hangman, you can be a good magistrate, and you can be a Christian leader of troops or baker, or anything of that kind. So it wasn't unworldly kind of thing. And if you weren't involved in some kind of religious occupation, that didn't put you ipso facto outside of God's area. I'll have to look it up. I'll have to go over that again because his doctrine
wasn't it partly that the left hand of God is the God is that which takes care of governmental things, and the right hand of God is that which takes care of the gospel. And those, and then I think the followers of Luther made that said that's where you don't divide it. And of course, I think we have we Lutherans have often taken what we consider the Constitution to make a separation mm-hmm. of church and state, and right hand of God, left hand of God. And isn't that a caricature of what Luther has said?
Mm-hmm.
Walt?
Yeah, well, yeah. The problem has been that God is, even for Luther's theology, God is to be sovereign in both realms.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And somehow the kingdom on the left got free almost of God's sovereignty so that the prince could almost do what he wanted without any sense of God's judgment involved. How about one more question and then we will draw things to a close. We're almost 10:30. You can see people
Jesus,
are
really?
Tired.
Oh my gosh.
I might throw in a different question.
Yeah, let's pop a hard one quick. So take it for 5 minutes and then stop.
I'm thinking about...
Check all paths, so that's what I was...
I was a child growing up, the public school was thought of as the function of the community and the school board. And the public school had a Christmas program that we learned the 23rd Psalm. And that was because the community wanted us to do that. Somewhere along the line, the public school became viewed as a creature of the state, and we get the separation of church and state argument whenever we talk about the possibility of any kind of discussion of religion in the school. How did that come about? traditionally, the school was the community's affair. It was not viewed as a creature of the state. But in the last 20 to 30 years, the school has become, the public school has become a creature of the state.
Do you mean state or national government?
And the separation of church and state has gotten applied very rigorously to public school. How did that thing come? How did that change come about?
Well, when you say state, because this is a touchy thing of states' rights, are you talking about state or state government, national government, federal government?
Is viewed, it has to be completely non-religious, the public school, because of separation of church and state. Now, that's the kind of argument one hears. 40 years ago, you didn't hear that argument. The school was but the community wanted the school to do, the school did.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the communities have become so mixed everywhere, and that can work both ways. Do you know there are more Muslims in Detroit now than, I mean, there's just an enormous number of Muslims, and so you better watch out or your schools will be Islamic. Mm-hmm. I think when the community had a very clear consensus and majority, like 99%, that's one thing. But when every community has become plural in its religious attitudes, then the school cannot establish any particular religion. But I do feel very strongly, as I said the other night, that what Secretary Bennett was saying is true, that schools don't have to be irreligious, and they certainly should not be eliminating any reference to religion when that reference is appropriate from a literary or historical point of view. I think that is just so... that is an abuse in the other direction. It's as bad as having children say the rosary or something. You know, it's going in the other direction, leaning in the other direction, and falsifying history, literature, and other things that children should be learning as they were written. And religion, learning what religion is, what Christianity is basically about, I think this should be taught through all grades, high school and college. And that's what we're doing, teaching in college, but what other religions are about as well. Religion is a fact in the world, and children should be instructed about it. They shouldn't be protected from it as though it were a lethal gas or something, and you seal them up and scour out their textbooks of any reference to it. That's unreal. And But I think that the teaching of any particular religion belongs to the parents, and when the child is old enough and decides to wander around and visit this or that church or synagogue or whatever, it's not the place of the school to inform with regard to doctrine in such a way as to indicate that a child should be this or that kind of, belong to this or that sort of religion.
Do you think then that the great music of the tradition should be as freely sung in the schools as any other place in our society? And can it be done at Christmas time that we learn the greatest music? You know, boy, you really get some very fuzzy lines here.
I know.
And I can feel the depth of the religious rites, feeling that that Christianity has really been excised from the public schools. And you can, at most, you can only talk about it in any kind of objective sense, in historical sense. But take the issue of celebration of Christmas and all that kind of thing. You can't get music programs where you have sacred music that implies Christ as part of Christmas. And I don't really know how one deals with that issue, but it the pluralism of our society has really forced these tremendous problems upon us.
I think they are, and I don't know how one resolves that sort of a question unless it's gives instruction in equal time to other religions that are fairly represented in the school. I don't mean if you have one Sikh that you have to have a Sikh holiday.
But I think the Supreme Court might say that if a Sikh brought it to the Supreme Court, they probably would say, yeah, you have to have a Sikh holiday if you're going to have a Christmas holiday or a Jewish holiday or something.
There's another way to look at it. Wasn't the creche allowed finally in Rhode Island or whatever it was?
Yeah, on secular grounds, wasn't it, Dan?
Whatever. But there's another side to that I think we have to be very sensitive to. I used to be manager of a school in India that regularly celebrated Christmas, and I can remember being invited to this Christmas program where the question was, who is Jesus Christ? And the headmaster said, Abu Bakr, and in case you wonder, that's a classic Muslim name. Abu Bakr, little Abu Bakr stands up proudly and he says, Jesus is the Son of God and the Son of Man. And his parents are there grinning, thinking it's wonderful how beautifully that boy said it. And yet you know that their faith is utterly this is absolute blasphemy to a Muslim. And so it has become meaningless. And is that what we want? As one of the big points made by a German missiologist is that very frequently we have inoculated our children against Christianity because we give them this nice overlay of all this Christian knowledge and never, somehow or other, commitment has not taken place. Which is true, you find the great leaders of India have a tremendous Christian knowledge, and yet they have opted against it.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that if it was, it wouldn't be a celebration that would be a religious celebration, but as an appropriate, music that's appropriate for this particular season, and I think then you'd have to really do something for Hanukkah. And I don't know what else you might end up doing in certain places, probably something Islamic.
Ramadan? Ramadan.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And certainly you have to allow people to celebrate those things themselves. But another area where you can't scrub religion out, Secretary Bennett mentioned this too, he said, I'd just like them to give a class in art history and try to eliminate religion from that.
What's the enunciation?
Yes.
Medieval art.
So I think I think what we've got to do is have discussions like this so that we begin to think about these things and try to arrive at some kind of a consensus or principles or something on which we can begin to work together to resolve some of these problems that increased pluralism and people coming in. I mean, we're not a little New England community of Lutherans or Calvinists or anybody else. We really are plural in the most profound sense everywhere. And we were having a little conversation with Ismail and I said, I think this is a bit new. We do have some principles, but when you try to apply them, it gets very, very difficult. And we need to come together. And I think we're being pushed that way. I think the pressures are building. And that just as we've decided that we've got to stop drugs, that's a national decision that no one is really going to say, I don't agree with that. That while we'll never get anything that clear cut, I think we're being pushed to come eventually to a consensus that will make these, that we can work with in some way, protecting the First Amendment and yet not cutting ourselves off at the knees with regard to our cultural heritage and our the richness that our religious diversity allows us in cult, in music and things of that kind.
Thank you. Let's stop at that.
Thank you. Thank you all.